Welcome to Vincent Price's Laugh.
Good evening, everybody. Hi, LB.
Hello, Andrew.
Hey, tonight's episode is going to be pretty sad. At least initially pretty sad. Because we're talking about Anton Yelchin.
He's one of our favorite actors.
Yes. And he recently died very tragically in a freak accident. We don't need to go over it. Most likely, you already know about it. But eventually, we would have talked about some of these movies anyway.
Yeah, I think so. I think that they would have been on our list.
One in particular. However,
We thought it would be nice to do a little memorial episode for Anton.
Yeah. So, before we get into the movies, Albie, when was the first time Anton Yelchin's presence hit your radar?
You know, I think maybe it was in Charlie Bartlett.
Yeah.
Which was a good film.
That was with me, too. It's a comedy drama.
Yeah.
With Robert Downey Jr.
Downey. But it got compared a lot to Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
But yeah, he was really resonant.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a kid at the time.
Yeah.
It was 2007 when we saw it, so.
And then after that, it was Terminator Salvation, which that movie gets a lot of crap.
Yeah.
We liked it.
We still like it. The director's cut is much better. He plays Kyle Reese. He studied how Michael Biehn is in order to do his Kyle Reese, which isn't an impression of Michael Biehn, but it's like an homage to Michael Biehn. That's why his acting really stood out. He was so credible, and especially for his scenes having very little to do with most of the other characters, and the rest of the movie is populated with bigger stars and so on, and they're over there. And so his Kyle Reese scenes had to stand on their own, and he did it. He did the job. Well, and then Star Trek, right?
Yeah, of course, Star Trek. I think maybe that's what he's most famous for, is being Chekhov.
Yeah.
And he does a really funny accent.
Well, he's Russian.
Yeah, I know. He's
Russian-American, so
right.
That's his accent. That's one of the benefits of casting him.
Yep.
In the original Star Trek, they cast Walter Koenig as Chekhov.
Nuclear vessels.
Mm-hmm. Because they wanted somebody who would appeal to the young ladies. Much in the same way that Davy Jones from The Monkees did.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say about Walter Koenig's adorableness or not, but Anton Yelchin, definitely adorable.
Yes.
Very much so.
He was very adorable as Chekhov. Delightful, I would say. Like, when he gets so excited, like when he's running through and he can figure out how to do the teleporter.
Yeah.
I can do that. I can do that. I can do that. I can do that. Give me manual control. I can lock on. Hold on! Compensating gravitational pull and...
It's so much fun.
Yeah, that's his scene.
He's so believable.
Yeah, that was really great.
But what I think is really interesting about Anton is his career choices in general. Every actor has different genre movies.
Usually actors start, and he didn't, but usually actors start in genre film and then they graduate away from it.
Well, right. Well, what I meant when I said genre just now is like various genres, not actually like the term genre film.
Right, like, meaning horror and science fiction.
Yeah, yeah. What I meant is like, you know, he did dramas and comedies and, you know, stuff like that. Every actor has that.
Like I said, earlier on, he's a child actor, so he's just put where the kid is necessary. But he was put in interesting and strange things still. I mean, he's in a Stephen King movie called Hearts in Atlantis.
Uh-huh.
He's in David Duchovny's directorial debut, House of D.
Mm-hmm.
He's in interesting projects, even as a child. And that just seemed to have grown. And even if he was in maybe a stinker, he was the most interesting and best part of that stinker.
Yeah, he was a very natural actor. He had something very relatable about all of his characters. Yeah.
There's a genuine look in his eye.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen him break. Like, you can see, here's a really bad example. DMX is not a good actor. And why? You can see in his eyes, he's got this little smile. And he's like,
I'm hardcore. I'm going to beat you up because I'm...
You're acting. You're totally acting. You're saying lines and I can see it in your eyes. I don't think I've ever seen that in Anton.
No, well, I think it's because of his performance background. What I mean is, you know, his parents were performers as well, ballet dancers. And I don't know if you've ever looked at his Instagram account.
It's all his just photography that he's taken.
And
he's got a couple of self-portraits, but...
Right. It's very... Well, I mean, it's like photos of model-y looking women and different places.
People he knows from Southern California, basically.
Yeah, and that's fine. But it's very artful.
And it's not just women. There's a bunch of dudes there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, sure. But, you know, the more striking ones, ones, I think, are of the women.
It's just because women look better. Always. No matter what.
It proves that he was a creative person who had a lot of chops.
Yeah, he was in a punk band for a while.
Oh, yeah. So we're really going to miss him. We're going to miss Anton a lot. And I think it's just because he's so cool.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to say how I heard it. I woke up and I got online. And Ron, my friend in Southern California, texts me.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately started looking up the information about it. And then I promptly got a bit wrecked.
Yeah.
And you heard it, what, minutes apart from when I heard it.
Right.
And then you called to me.
And you know, it hit us hard because it's weird the nature of celebrity. Because you feel like you are their friends because they are like so easily accessible through social media and other outlets like that, that you feel like you're really a part of their lives because they're a part of your life.
I can say honestly though, I didn't follow Anton at all online.
Right.
Only whenever I saw an article in which he spoke about this or that project that he was doing would I read it and look at it. But his Instagram, that's all he had. He didn't have a Twitter or a Facebook.
Yeah, yeah.
He just had his Instagram and there was just his photos that he took.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't. He's different because he kept himself out of the limelight.
Yeah, he's a very humble person. And you know what? He also seemed bashful, like in interviews.
Well, it all depends. TV interviews, I think. Camera interviews. Yeah. It seems like he's bashful. But then I've heard audio interviews in which he's a riot.
Mm-hmm.
Just funny as all get out. Just making up stuff about the movie that he's in because he obviously, during the making of the movie, can't put spoilers out and the interviewer is gonna ask about this or that thing that his character's going through, and so he just makes up a bunch of stuff and it's so funny because
mm-hmm.
it's like naturally funny. It's not stand-up comedy funny. It's not written funny. It's just genuine. Seems that that's what I'm gonna miss about him, is his genuine presence.
Yeah.
He's organic in his acting.
Yes.
So here we're gonna talk about a few movies that he's done. Some of them are definite watches. Some of them maybe not, but we're going to talk about him and his performances in them, and maybe what was right or wrong with the film.
Yeah.
So what do we got?
Well, the first thing we're going to talk about is Odd Thomas.
My name is Odd Thomas, but I do lead an unusual life.
That must be for you.
I found a gateway to hell.
Any of those Bodach things around?
Bodach. And they do show up, it's a sure sign that carnage and bloodshed are not far behind. This town is in serious trouble.
Odd Thomas.
Ah, Odd Thomas.
Now, this is a movie that a lot of people really love and a lot of people really hate. And most of the people who really hate it are critics. And most of the people who really love it are fans.
Fans of genre, fans of Anton, and fans of the writer.
Dean Koontz. A lot of people think this film is underrated. I have to say personally that I don't agree with that.
You think it's just rated?
we'll get into that in a moment. So this is a Dean Koontz novel that was adapted for the screen by Stephen Sommers.
Now, Dean Koontz is a rival to Stephen King.
Yeah.
We all know that. I've read Stephen King before. I've never read Dean Koontz before. So I don't know the style differences or story differences. I think I have seen maybe one or two Dean Koontz adaptations for TV.
Mm-hmm.
And they were done in the 90s, so they were throwaway.
Right. Just about like anything else done in the 90s.
Yeah. That were adaptations of scary books.
Yeah.
Even Stephen King.
Yeah, yeah. Those terrible miniseries.
Yeah.
Where, like the Tommyknockers and stuff.
Yes.
Like,
okay, so that's actually Tommyknockers. Knockers and Invasion. Dean Koontz, I think, had a thing called Invasion. But this, I'm going to just assume that there was a lot of subtlety and nuance in the story that Dean Koontz wrote. Because what we got on screen is not that at all.
No, and what's surprising is, okay, so Dean Koontz really loves this movie. Surprising to me because normally an author who sees a screen adaptation of their novel isn't too happy with it.
Well, it all depends, but yeah, Stephen King has been really happy and he's also been really unhappy. Dean Koontz always hates it, right?
Right. So he told his agent, he was like, hey, if anybody approaches about doing any sort of adaptation of anything from now on, because I guess he had been burned in the past or something.
Sure.
Don't tell them yes or no right away. Just send it to me and I'll look at it and I'll decide. So he found out that Stephen Sommers wanted to do a version of Odd Thomas, and he was like,
oh yeah, great idea.
Stephen Sommers, if you don't know, he made The Mummy.
Uh-huh.
And before he made The Mummy, he did this movie called Deep Rising, which was pre-Asylum, Attack of the Giant Sea Monster type movie. But it was pretty great for what it is. There's a lot of action movie beats and a lot of tentacle monster beats, mm-hmm. and it was really great for what it was. You watch it now, it seems like the best sci-fi production ever. But back then, it was pretty solid. But that was just a calling card. And then he did The Mummy, which got him his big hoo-ha! He also did, like, Huck Finn or something before.
Yeah, okay. Is The Mummy good? Because
the first Mummy is like an Indiana Jones movie with some weird CG thrown in, but it's not the worst CG, especially for 1998. But the second Mummy is terrible, and that introduces The Rock's Scorpion King.
Right.
Which spun off into its own series, Stupid Head Scorpion King. It's really dumb. But Stephen Sommers' career just kept going. Instead of doing The Mummy 3, somebody else did that. He did Van Helsing.
Oh, right.
Which was all the way terrible.
I don't remember watching Van Helsing or The Mummy. I know that I watched them with you at some point after we got married, but like at the time that they came out, I just skipped over them both because I was like,
Yeah, you were good to do so. Mummy's all right. Mummy 2 is terrible. Van Helsing's the worst.
Yeah, it seemed that way.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, everything is just done in this very comic booky for no good reason.
Ah, comic booky.
Blech.
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 So, what's even funnier to me is that Dean Koontz, after seeing this movie, was blown away by Stephen Sommers' stylistic choices.
Oh, we haven't even gotten to the good stuff.
I know!
When you watch this movie, what you get is a movie that looks like any other person directed it. It doesn't look like the guy who directed The Mummy directed it, which I guess Van Helsing looks like the guy who directed The Mummy directed it. Mummy 2 looks like the guy who directed The Mummy directed it, with cutting corners so it looks cheaper. But this movie, it does not look at all. Oh, we missed one. He directed G.I. Joe.
Oh.
That looked like a Stephen Sommers movie. So after Stephen Sommers established the way he directs action through all these other movies, you get this one, and this one just looks like somebody else directed it. He wrote the screenplay, but he took out so much, it seems. He told us instead of showed us.
Right.
There's a narration with Anton, and it sounds good because it's Anton and his voice.
That's Tom Jed. He was my little league coach. Been hanging around Tire World for years. Although, I don't know why. His death was not caused by a defective tire.
But it's still kind of lacking in
if you've
heart,
seen,
in a way.
It is. Not his heart.
Yeah, not...
It's a Blade Runner problem.
Mm-hmm.
Blade Runner had been released in theaters with a narration because the test audience was a little sleepy without it, and they needed to be told, at least they requested to be told what was going on as opposed to showed what was going on.
Yeah.
So they had Harrison Ford dub this hard-boiled detective guy telling you the bigger picture that you need to understand as it goes along. And that's what this movie did, instead of showing you.
And it really didn't need that at all. It's a story that is not hard to follow.
Mm-mm.
So there's really no reason for any kind of narration like that other than, I mean, I haven't read this novel, so maybe it's the style of the novel and he was trying to keep
the voice of the narrator in the novel. That makes sense, that he loves the words that are on the page initially.
So you know what? We haven't even talked about what the story of this film is.
Okay. Anton is a young man who has Buffy the Vampire Slayer skills, except even more so, he sees things that no one else can see.
Yeah, he has special abilities. It's a precognition in a way.
Yes, he has precognition and he can see dead people and other spiritual entities.
Mm-hmm.
And they're these spiritual entities that vibe that the tragedy is going to happen, and then they hang out until that tragedy happens so that they can just eat because they gorge on the fear and misery that is surrounding that tragedy. They look like that semi-clear plastic bag that you get from a grocery store. They look like they're made out of that.
Yeah.
Except they're also like, kind of corporeal and skeletal.
Like silver balloons.
A mylar? No.
Yeah.
Not so much mylar, because mylar isn't clear. I mean, it is kind of clear, but...
Yeah. So he's able to see these beings, and he has this responsibility that he's put upon himself to try to prevent these tragedies from happening or to avenge the dead spirits or try to help them come to rest so that they may pass on.
Willem Dafoe is in the movie, and he's the friend mentor of Thomas, whose actual name is Odd Thomas. But the deal is, Anton, I'm not looking for this, okay? I don't necessarily like this movie. I thought it was good enough. Okay, it's a nice Saturday diversion, which is all you can really ask for in a movie. But Anton's performance, in spite of how the material was written and directed, in spite of all of that, his performance is solid.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to get into it because it'll spoil a thing in the movie. But there's a point where he's genuinely sad in the film. And all the direction up until that point undercuts that scene because that scene is so honest in his sadness. He has this realization and then real tears well up and all that. Had the film been directed in a different way, in a better way, you would have really felt it.
Yeah, well, there's...
I kind of felt it.
The problem is, okay, Odd has a girlfriend. Her name is Stormy, and they're destined to be together forever. That has been set up in their past by one of those fortune-telling machines, like in Big.
Yeah.
So they have this really complex and awesome relationship that kind of falls flat in this film, in my opinion. It's not really the performance's fault. I mean,
No, actually, they have charisma.
They do.
Their togetherness. I believe it.
But I don't think that their characters were quite developed enough in the script.
You're right. As I said before, this is a Saturday afternoon movie. When you're tired, lazy, you might not mind falling asleep.
Yeah, it's true. There's a certain point where I get really bored watching this film. We watched it twice.
Yeah.
And the second time, I was just like, I'm gonna look at my phone now.
The bigger mystery is actually kind of interesting. I'm not dissing the story itself. What I'm actually disappointed with, I should say, is Stephen Sommers.
Yes. It's true. The story of this could be quite compelling, and probably is if you read the novel series. You know, there are 7 novels.
Well, I don't know which one this was taken from.
I think it's the first one.
First?
Yeah, man, without Anton Yelchin, this movie is kind of unbearable to me.
Yeah.
Sorry, everybody.
I think so. He's the anchor, the rudder. Of course, it would be him anyway. Whoever is in the lead role has to do it.
Yeah, that's true.
And he did it.
And you know, Willem Dafoe was really impressed with him as well.
I think anybody who's ever acted with him.
You said he was struck by how good he was.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. I mean, if I was an actor and Willem Dafoe said something like that about me,
yeah,
I'd be so stoked.
Stoked.
So yeah, I mean, Odd Thomas, like it if you want to. I'm not going to fault you for liking it. I mean, it is a cool story, but I don't think I'm going to watch it ever again.
Right. So the next movie is also not a great one. It is Burying the X.
I promise we will always be together.
Always and forever. Surprise! So, do you love it or do you love it?
We have to make these sorts of decisions together.
You can go to hell.
You gotta do something about that broad, bro.
Text dump her. It's quick, easy, and depending on your wireless plan, it could even be free.
I can't text dump her.
You don't have unlimited texting?
Evelyn, please.
You were gonna break up with her anyways, remember?
What am I supposed to do?
All the things you used to love to do.
Hey, ladies! Max is single and ready to mingle!
Hey! Olivia.
Max.
Are you doing anything? Like, right now?
To moving on.
To moving on. Travis, it's Evelyn. She's back.
Your girlfriend is so gone. Who does her makeup?
And she thinks we're still dating.
There's a freaking Tim Burton movie in your living room.
Embalming fluid.
911 emergency.
My girlfriend came back from the dead and then she ate my brother and now she's gonna eat me.
Bury the X.
It is by Joe Dante, who seems to have somewhat fallen in recent years. His last movie that I remember him doing that was perfect was Matinee. After that,
he's just working.
Small Soldiers was okay, trying to get back to the Gremlins thing, not quite achieving it because they're not monsters, they're toys. And then Working, like you just said. He's done a couple of horror things. He did Masters of Horror, which weren't terrible, but they just didn't feel like Joe Dante. And this is something that I think he's trying to get back to the Joe Dante-ness, but it didn't seem as fleshed out, no pun intended, the zombie flesh, you know.
Right.
But what it is it's a guy and his horrible girlfriend, played by Ashley Greene. and the guy is obviously Anton Yelchin. And she does something terrible, and that is taking his posters off the wall, which is not so bad. But how she did it is she just folded them up and tucked them away, and they're now worthless because they were worth something. His posters were old vintage movie posters.
Well, I think the offense really is, okay, so they're living together in this apartment, and they're trying to have a life together because they're so in love. And she comes and she decides to redecorate everything, and it has nothing of his personality.
Sure.
It's all her.
I think the offense is that he was realizing this already.
Right.
And hadn't gotten his guts in a bunch enough to confront her and say, look, we're done. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're not that compatible. And this redecoration that you just did is a metaphor for that.
Yeah, it's all her. It's no him. So he gets upset and leaves. Somehow she dies. He works in a Halloween store and he meets a very nice young lady played by Alexandra Daddario. I can't say her name. Yeah, Daddario. She's got a Greek name. It's Daddario. 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 I don't know.
Hey, Bobbery Bob.
So he meets this cool girl. He does end up breaking up with his girlfriend, except she's dead, and through some hoodoo voodoo, some sort of weird thing at the Halloween store, she comes back to life and assumes that they're still a couple. And therein lies all the comedy, ha ha, and hijinks, and
yeah.
Some of it's gross, some of it's funny, some of it's not funny, some of it's lame. So it's an uneven sort of comedy horror.
It's cute, but it's kind of
forgettable.
Yeah, I didn't want to say throwaway, but it's another one of those Saturday afternoon movies that you just put on and maybe you take a nap.
Maybe you watch it all.
Yeah.
So we got two stinkers out of the way.
So we want to talk about a movie that we really, really enjoy, and we hope that you also enjoy.
There are flaws here, but there are not the kind of flaws that you think.
Yeah.
Many people think that because this movie exists, that it is a flaw,
yeah,
that it exists.
It's already flawed because it was imagined into being.
Yeah, but it's not the case. The movie that we're talking about is Fright Night.
That guy, your neighbor?
Jerry.
I think he's a vampire.
He's not brooding or lovesick. He's actually quite modern.
Welcome to Fright Night.
He's the shark from Jaws.
Just hit him! Hit him!
That looked like it hurt.
Fright Night.
You can't get in without an invitation.
Don't need an invitation if there's no house.
Rated R.
Now, this was remade at a time where vampire movies were starting to become old hat.
Oh, yeah. Twilight was out.
Twilight was out. A bunch of different other companies were trying to jump on the Twilight train.
I don't know what other properties
I
there
don't
were.
Either.
There's television shows that were doing vampire things. But in cinema, the vampire at the time wasn't really, and it hasn't really. Twilight is an anomaly. Call those vampires.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking about like the TV shows, like you were saying. Like what's that one with Ian Somerhalder?
I don't care.
Right? I don't care either, but it's a thing. The general feeling at the time was like this love story, sensitive vampire, all thanks to Edward Cullen.
Oh, wait, it has to be sexy lover boy vampire.
Right,
or,
right.
Or bust, right?
Right. So it became this dramatic thing that everyone was sick of. So it was announced that Fright Night was being remade and people were...
Knee jerk.
Yeah, like, oh no, another...
Oh, they're going to WB the thing.
Oh,
they're going to make it look like a CW show. Bleh.
Right. Because, you know, I mean, honestly, Fright Night is one of those older movies that does have a good following. And,
it's got
and
this hugest
reason.
Following. Now, the original Fright Night came out in the mid-80s, and it was a response to the slasher movie. It was an homage, loving homage to Hammer horror movies.
Right.
But it was a... God, I'm sick of these slashers.
Right, the chainsaw movies, the summer camp movies, like all these things that...
Were a dime a dozen. They
yeah.
were constantly popping up. If not, a franchise was still going in Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, then it was a one-off. And there were tons of one-offs.
Yeah. So Tom Holland made Fright Night, and it was unlike anything that was going on at the time.
Now, we recently rewatched this thing just to compare and contrast the two Fright Nights, the two original Fright Nights. So Fright Night 1 and Fright Night 1. Because they
both have sequels. Yeah.
So Fright Night, Tom Holland, is very dopey, dorky, melodramatic, and silly, like sitcom rules comedy. for the first two thirds. And there are some things that ring true. The mother relationship with him pretty much.
Are you talking about how true. Like Amy gets mad at him for really stupid reasons?
Yes, for absolutely no good reason.
Stops talking to him.
Right. Or is like she puts some other dude's right. burger in his face.
Oh, you're so cool, Brewster. I can't stand it.
Yeah.
Whatever. And his relationship with Ed.
Are they actually friends in the
no,
first movie?
No, in this movie they don't seem like friends.
Very funny, Brewster. Don't call me evil anymore. Why should I help you anyway?
So there's like the sensitivity that Evil has in the original movie that he has to the name Evil. But he's also a weirdo creep who really likes gore, Fangoria, horror stuff, and serial killer knowledge. So he's got this bad reputation about him. People think he's a dark creep.
Yeah.
And in the movie, he is a dark creep.
You know what I heard on the police band last night? That wasn't the only murder. The second in 2 days. And get this, both of them had their heads chopped off. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
With an obnoxious laugh.
So that's what's completely different about the remake of Fright Night. And it kind of took me watching them both together to realize that I don't prefer the first one. And the reason is that relationship between Charlie Brewster and Evil Ed. In the remake, it's so completely different. They have like this backstory, this background.
Charlie Brewster is not a good kid in the remake.
No, I mean, he starts out as a
good kid. He's charming. He's cute, but he's not a good kid. He's gone from nerd to cool kid.
Right, exactly. That's the thing. He's coming to grips with that.
And as cool kid, he has to leave his old friend behind because his old friend doesn't want to be with the cool kids. And he's played by Chris Mintz-Plasse, who is kind of dorky looking. So he can't get away from looking like a dork.
Really? Can we just pretend for 1 minute that you're not a complete douchebag?
Evil, this was fun when we were 8.
Try 16.
Whatever, man. Point is, I grew up. If you don't want to, that's fine. But don't get an attitude because I'd rather have a life than make shit up.
I get it. You're so cool, Brewster.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, they used to make these silly superhero videos with like role-playing.
LARPing and...
Yeah.
And that's embarrassing.
It's so totally embarrassing to Charlie now because he's somehow fallen in with the cool crowd.
He wants to hang out with Dave Franco.
Yeah.
And we all know Dave Franco is a cutie.
But in the first version of Fright Night, in the original version, there's none of that.
There's no groundwork.
There's no groundwork. Like I said a few minutes ago, are they even friends? Yeah.
And so, here, it's obvious that they were friends.
So that's part of why the first half of the original Fright Night is just kind of boring and weird and like, okay, let's get to the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't really care about those characters. And Charlie himself is just nuts. He's perceived as just acting crazy and, you know, paranoid.
Yeah, and it kind of comes out of nowhere.
Right.
So, as you just mentioned, you have a problem with the relationship with him and his best friend in the original.
Mm-hmm.
It's not his best friend. In the new version, it is his best friend, or ex-best friend. What I have a problem with in the original is his relationship with Amy.
Ah.
It's a terrible relationship. It is an 80s teen relationship. They want to take it further. He wants to bed her, and she does not want to be bedded, except she does want to be bedded, and that's sexually frustrating him. And that's as deep as their relationship goes.
Yeah.
And that's annoying. But when you get to the remake, I think Anton was amazing. Because every movie that I've ever seen him in, starring opposite a lady that is his love interest, he has amazing chemistry with them.
That's true.
You believe them.
Mm-hmm.
What a charmer. Right?
Yeah.
Like, here it's Imogen Poots, who's a nice looking young lady, and an even nicer personality. Much nicer in here as Amy than
Amanda Bierce
as Amy in the original. Like, she gets annoyed once in the remake.
Right, because he's acting a little bit weird. And
she just gets annoyed. She doesn't throw food in his face. She doesn't stomp off. She goes, okay, I can see you've got something going on. I'm gonna go. She's not the worst girlfriend ever. It's played totally differently and much better.
Yeah, yeah. They both have much better character arcs in the remake. All of them.
Yeah. Now, the vampires are pretty identical.
Yeah, in a way.
I mean, like, concept-wise, they're identical. Mm. Chris Sarandon plays it. By the way, Chris Sarandon's eating the fruit. The reason why is because he did all this research about bats. And so, as a theatrical-type person, he wrote the back story for his own vampire guy, which was that he had a lot of fruit bat DNA as well.
Oh, okay. And
so, usually, after or before feeding, he would eat
an apple
to clean his palate.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And this is brought over into the new version of the film with Colin Farrell also playing the same Jerry Dandridge vampire.
That is a terrible vampire name, Jerry.
But amazingly.
Yeah.
Chris Sarandon was great, but Colin Farrell's version is different in that the same motivations and everything, but he's so layered in his performance. A lot of people said that he was a bad actor in this movie. I don't think so. I think he's acting badly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not bad acting, it's acting badly. So he's trying to beckon him out or get invited in, and that performance looks on the surface like it's so bad. But beneath the surface, he's just trying to coax him out. And I know it seems so simple, but when you watch a performance, it's really nuanced, it's subtle, and it's amazing.
The motivation behind the character of Jerry Dandridge in the Fright Night remake came from Craig Gillespie, the director. He wanted him to be a serial killer. He wanted to treat this vampire film as a serial killer.
Serial killer lives next door.
Yes. So if you think of it in that way, like a Ted Bundy, okay? He's very charming, very handsome, has a lot of charisma.
Yeah. Smooth talker.
Yeah, but is ultimately just devoid of emotion.
Right.
And what do serial killers do? When they want to coax you to do something, they have this performance that they do. And that is exactly how Colin Farrell did this.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So I applaud Colin Farrell and his portrayal.
Indeed.
Yeah.
The Peter Vincent character is different.
Yes.
Both Peter Vincents are different. And the name Peter Vincent comes from Peter Cushing and Vincent Price merged. And originally, Roddy McDowall was not to be cast. It was going to go to Vincent Price, but Vincent Price had, at the time, had it with being typecast in horror. So he said, no, thank you. And Roddy McDowall was suggested to him.
Huh.
And Roddy McDowall and Vincent Price are old friends. And Tom Holland was once invited to a party that Roddy McDowall was throwing. And Vincent Price was there. And Vincent Price acknowledged and said, thank you. What a nice homage. And then talked up his friend's performance.
Yeah.
Bringing it back to Vincent Price.
So yeah, Roddy McDowall did do a good job for what?
He was a washed up actor who used to star in these old Hammer movies.
Right.
And he was a horror host by the time that we get to him in this movie. And
he just gets fired because of the new American love for slasher movies.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to see vampire movies anymore.
Nobody wants to see the Monster Hunter.
Mm-mm.
They want to see kids get dashed to pieces by a guy with a machete. So his motivation is purely, initially, out of greed to help the kids, only because
she pays him.
Yeah, Amy pays him.
Mm-hmm.
So he eventually learns that the vampire's real, and then, oh god, oh god, oh god, he's Cowardly Lion.
Yep, but then there's David Tennant.
David Tennant's version is
Chris Angel.
Yeah, basically a Chris Angel guy. Well, he's Chris Angel, but he's, when you watch Chris Angel, you see another guy who's actually quite charismatic, and he seems light. Even though he dresses dark and gross and lame and douchey, he has a light way to speak to people. Friendly, very friendly. But Tennant's character doesn't have that.
He's really abrasive.
He's super abrasive. Yeah. He's very cynical.
Yeah, and he is an expert in vampire lore.
Yeah.
So, I'm the expert for your vampire thing, huh?
They're all right, eh? Shoot.
Right. Well, look, I know your show is an illusion.
Yeah, fair enough.
But say I wanted to kill a vampire.
Yeah, sorry, go on.
How would I go about doing that?
You want to know how to kill a vampire? Seriously?
Yeah, kill a vampire.
Well, let's think. Well, you got fire. Beheading. You can make him a big garlicky omelet. Or go traditional. Steak through the heart. BAM!
Cool, so that stuff really works?
Well, Maybe not the omelette.
But he says it's just a hobby.
Yeah, he has this room of different vampire memorabilia and...
even a revolver with silver bullets.
Yeah.
Which is for werewolves. But he turns the kid down because, like, come on.
He's like, really?
You believe in this hokum?
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Now, evil in the original movie is, as we said, an obnoxious and abrasive guy. And his scene, he never has a confrontation with Brewster at all.
That's correct. He
fights Roddy McDowall.
Mm-hmm.
And in the remake, he does have a confrontation, which brings their past relationship to the forefront again.
Yeah.
And it's all about context, and it's great.
Look, Ed, if you have a problem, just keep it with me, okay?
Oh, do I got a problem? You let him get to me, man. You let him turn me into this. We got some catching up to do, my friend. Oh, it's just you and me now, buddy. Mano a mano. Let's do this.
Mm-hmm. So, you're very emotionally involved.
Yeah, because they set it up.
Uh-huh.
From the very beginning. Now, the disappointment in this film, the remake versus the original, is just in some of the vampire face transformations.
Yeah, the special effects that they use in the remake, like the vampire fangs faces, like the big monster faces, the infamous Amy mouth, or
yeah,
Jerry's actual vampire face,
yeah,
are kind of corny, kind of cheesy, because they don't look real enough. If you compare them to the practical effects that they used in the first film, and those practical effects are like mind-blowingly good.
Big vampire teeth. It's just prosthetic makeup all over the faces. Amy's big grin is really interesting because she could open her mouth and you could see inside of it, mm-hmm. but you don't see the actor's cheeks. It's all great makeup job. There's no other way that they can do it. It
looks so real. Like, if I met a vampire, I would expect it to look like that in real life.
That's a weird statement. If I met a vampire, I would hope it wouldn't look like that in real life.
Well, I mean...
Or maybe I would hope it does look like that so I could stay away from it.
What I'm saying is, like, I don't expect it to look very, like, fluid and perfect.
Like the liquid animation.
Yeah.
All CG. The problem with a lot of CG stuff is that it doesn't have the flaw that we do in our movements.
Right.
Or it's always liquid. It always moves like it's animated.
Yeah, that's a problem that Odd Thomas had as well.
But each finale echoes each other. They both have to do with sunlight. They both have the locked in the room with the vampire girl.
Yeah.
And they're good and great for it.
Yeah, I think Marty Noxon, the screenwriter, I think she did a really great job in...
fleshing everybody out.
It's amazing.
We didn't even talk about the moms. Toni Collette plays the mom in the remake, and she's great. You believe that she's a cool mom who actually has the respect of her son.
Mm-hmm.
And not cool mom who's desperate for the respect of her son. Everybody is pretty well adjusted in this movie.
Yeah.
It's great because I'm tired of seeing everybody who's not well adjusted. I mean, we have enough of that in our own lives.
Oh, that's deep.
Oh, yeah. Let's have some of the opposite in our fiction, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. We saw it in 3D in the theater, and the 3D was solid. Especially at the end, with all the light refracting on the dust particles. It was really neat.
Yeah.
I highly recommend this movie, Fright Night. Both are good in their own ways. I really like the ending of the original. I really like all of the new ones.
Yeah. As far as story and characters and development, I really love the Fright Night remake. Love it. Best thing about the first Fright Night? Jay Giles. Putting that out there. So the last film that we're going to discuss, I actually did not see.
I did.
I didn't see it not because I didn't think it would be any good. I didn't see it because I thought that it would hit me too hard. And I'm not that kind of person. Like, I can take a lot of stuff.
It's Green Room.
You guys are hard to find. Why no social media presence?
Music is shared live. It's time and aggression. You gotta be there.
Sorry, guys. Gotta clear out. Follow me?
And then it's over.
I told
told you to follow me.
Stop!
You can't keep us here. You gotta let us go.
We're not keeping you. You're just staying.
What do we do? Oh, shit.
This will be over soon, gentlemen.
What are they doing?
They're coming.
We gotta go.
And we die.
The longer we wait, the surer that is.
Is that a pep talk? Just grab some shit, get ready to run.
Here we go.
I see the bad moon horizon. I see trouble on the way.
They're everywhere!
You breathing? Let him bleed.
Careful now.
I can't die here.
There's a bad moon.
So don't.
Green room.
Now, this being the last thing I saw of Anton before his untimely demise, holy moly, man.
You talk about, ever since you've seen the movie,
yeah,
at least once or twice a week, you just randomly
get flashes like PTSD of this movie. Now, Green Room is about a naive and idealistic punk band who goes on the road. And they get stiffed out of a show from a radio DJ slash promoter, and he wants to make it up to them, so he gets his cousin to vouch for the band so that they can play another show deeper into the woods of Oregon, where there's a lot of right-wing militant skinheads. And so they play this show, and they leave their phone backstage in the green room, and they go back to get it, and they see something that they should not have seen. And then they get stuck. And it turns into a siege movie where they are stuck in the green room and they have to escape a paramilitary force. Now, the movie was directed with the intent to make it a war movie by the director, Jeremy Saulnier, I think his name is. But what he ended up as an end product was real horror, which I suppose war is real horror. I've never been in the thick of war, so I'm only going to assume war is horror. I don't know why I wouldn't assume that. The premise is very simple. Patrick Stewart is the big bad boss.
What are the dynamics of the characters?
Aaliyah Shawkat is in this, and she's from Arrested Development. She's just like cool chick in the band.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the guys, cool, very even rapport with all the people. The bassist and the drummer, well, I forget if Anton played the bassist or not. There's one dude, one guy in the band, who is the guy. He's the guy who was on the wrestling team. He was the guy who is aggressive and does what needs to be done. The other guys, they all have band dynamics. If you've ever seen a band or been in a band or knew friends in a band, they all have these character types. And this being a naive, as I said, and idealistic punk band, they have philosophies of not recording music and only playing live because music is an experience, a shared experience, and if you record it, it takes the life out of the song and all that stuff. And Anton says these things in the interview, and he is so believably full of it. You roll your eyes and you go, I know this guy.
He's going on his own experiences being in a band.
Maybe.
Some pretentious punk.
Yeah, it's a pretentious punk thing. But they're not a bad punk band. Their tunes are rip-roaring punk tunes.
You know, this movie kind of makes me think it's like Scott Pilgrim Goes to Hell.
Oh, yeah, in a way. Yeah, it's like a Scott Pilgrim Goes to Hell. Scott Pilgrim versus neo-Nazis. There's humor in it, but it's not a funny movie. It is all pitchest, blackest, darkest humor. And he's reunited with Imogen Poots.
Careful now.
Who is a skinhead girl who isn't part of the skinheads. She's just like traditional, likes the music, was there with her friend, and then she gets caught up in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have to escape. Finally, I can't talk about the ending of it, but it is one heavy movie. And it is helped to be even heavier by the performances of everybody in the cast. But again, Anton is leading it.
Now, I saw Blue Ruin,
yeah,
which was the film the director made before this one.
Yes, which is real life Batman.
It was heavy, and...
It was slower.
It was slower. At the end of it, I was kind of speechless.
That's this kind of movie.
Okay.
Now, he said he was going to strike while the iron's hot to get this movie made because there's no way that he could get this movie made any other time than now. Than when he did make it, because he's fielding requests, submissions, and looking for new director jobs in Hollywood, and Hollywood's gonna snatch him up and give him something different that he cannot make. This super violent, super hardcore movie.
Yeah.
The way that this movie was made. This movie is brutal. It's just the worst. You guys like Game of Thrones, I'm sure, and there's a lot of brutality. You get it like once every two episodes or something brutal happens where we see it on camera. Well, this is the whole movie of all those brutal moments.
So is there any sort of relief to it? I mean, I know you mentioned
there are calm moments.
A little bit of humor.
Very brief. It's not a lot of humor to it. But in every movie, there has to be downtime. There has to be quiet time. There has to be a time where you, the audience, has a breath to catch.
Right.
Hardcore Henry has no breaks. A musical number is not a break.
It's just confusing.
It kind of is, but it's not a break. It's clever, but it's not a break.
Yeah.
You're still like really actively engaged. This movie, Green Room, has breaks appropriately for you to catch your breath. For you to also try to figure out how they can get out.
Mm-hmm. So it feels like you are there.
Yes. You feel a lot of the anxiety. And when things happen,
mm-hmm.
well, you know me. I talk to the screen. Okay. Not in the movie theaters, usually. But I did with this one.
Yeah.
You know how I am at home if I see something terribly lacerating or painful. I go,
I
did that plenty of times in the theater. Granted, there were... only three people in the theater or something. But Green Room, highly recommend it. It might leave you with some PTSD.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to watch it, but I don't know. Maybe one day when I feel like I have my anxiety and dread under check. I don't know. I'm sure it's a beautiful piece of art. I'm sure it's great. I'm sure that everything about it, I'm sure there's nothing to complain about.
There's nothing. It is a perfect movie. Of its kind of movie, it's a perfect movie. It's amazing. It really is. It's hard for me to even say that because it is such a violent movie. And I'm for all kinds of stylish, silly violence because it's cartoons. Horror movies are basically cartoons in a very big way. But when it gets down to this kind of realistic brutality, it has a lasting effect on the well-adjusted. I consider myself pretty well-adjusted, and it is like witnessing war. But all of this is to say, Anton Yelchin and his work will be missed.
And it will be remembered. Thank you, Anton, for being brilliant.
And doing what you did.
It really enriched our lives, and there's a big void in cool movies.
Yeah. Well, on that somber note, we're going to leave you. We hope you look into these movies, any other movies that he's done. He's got, I think, 5 more coming out.
Thanks a lot for listening, everybody.
Sorry for bringing everybody down, but really, let's celebrate the guy.
That's all we can do now.
Yeah.
And hope that he is at peace.
Good night.
Good night.
This podcast is brought to you by Ouch My Ego. Visit ouchmyego.com.
We're going to miss Anton a lot.